Those of us who live in the West and are citizens of Western countries know that our governments like to talk about the rule of law. We're all supposed to be proud that we live by the rule of law under governments that respect their constitutions, their basic laws, and court precedents. With that said, those of us who have worked for our country's respective intelligence services and national law enforcement organizations know that's just not the way things are in real life. Certainly, our governments talk a lot about law and order and human rights. But what happens when one realizes those same governments are breaking the law, both domestically and internationally? What happens when you can't report wrongdoing through your chain of command because it's the chain of command committing the crime? I'm John Kiriakou. We'll talk about that and more on this episode of The Whistleblowers. Annie Machon is a former intelligence officer from MI5, the UK's domestic intelligence service. When she began her career with the British government, Machon intended to become a diplomat. But as happens in many countries, in the midst of the process, she was recruited by MI5 and sent to work in the organization's counter-subversion department, known as F2. She later told the Yorkshire Post that her job included, quote, trying to track down old communists, Trotskyites, and fascists, which seemed like a waste of time, unquote. During the 1992 general election, Machon and her partner, David Shaler, were tasked with providing summaries on literally anybody who stood for election to parliament. Machon later said that she and Shaler were horrified by the scale of the investigations, and they argued MI5 should not be in the business of spying on people who had never even been suspected of committing a crime. 2 years later, she and Shaler transferred to T Branch, which investigated Irish terrorism. In 1996, however, life for both Machon and Shaler changed forever. In October of that year, both of them resigned from MI5 with the intention to blow the whistle on crimes they had seen committed inside that service. These crimes included maintaining secret files on the government's ministers responsible for overseeing the intelligence services, illegal phone taps, making false statements to government overseers, failing to prevent bombings by the Irish Republican Army, failing to prevent the 1994 bombing of the Israeli embassy in London, and the attempted assassination of then-Libyan leader Muammar al-Qaddafi. Machon and Shaler went on to the media with proof of their allegations, and that's when their problems began. We want to introduce our guest now, Annie Machon. Welcome. Annie, first I want to ask you about your decision to enter MI5 in the first place. You strike me as someone who has a conscience, someone who would never have been comfortable working on the other side of the law. It's clear that illegalities allegedly committed by MI5 bothered you from the outset. I was exactly the same way at the CIA. Tell me about joining MI5 and about your initial impressions when you started reading those secret files, files that were clearly inappropriate.
So I was recruited in 1990, a long time ago now. And this was 1 year after MI5 had been put on an official footing for the first time in 80 years of its existence with the Security Service Act. And also when the new Official Secrets Act came into play, which was there to stop whistleblowing. That was both in 1989. During my recruitment, I was told time and time again that they had changed, that they no longer had to look at counter-espionage because the Soviet Union was disintegrating. They no longer had to look for reds under the bed, i.e. political activists in the UK, because the Soviet Union was disintegrating. And they needed a new generation of intelligence officer to investigate terrorists. And that's what I thought I was signing up to do. The recruitment process was about 10 months in my case. It can go between 6 to a year in terms of recruitment. And I was reassured every time I got through. I didn't think I was the right type of person for this job. And every time I still kept getting through. And I thought by the end of it, I was quite reassured and that it would be a good job to do and it would make a difference and potentially save lives, actually. I mean, it sounds idealistic, but that's what I wanted to do. So that's why I joined. In terms of the things I saw on the inside, my first disillusionment was the fact that I was posted to the red under the bed section, which was known as F2. Where they were still looking at political subversives, political activists, that sort of thing. And we saw a huge number of files. When I say we, my and my former partner, David Shaler, who became the primary whistleblower in 1997, saw a huge number of files held not just on, you know, regular UK citizens, but also people who are in politics, many of whom became part of the Labour government in the 1997 general election. So you have a situation where the notional political masters of MI5 and MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Agency, had files held on them. So, you know, in terms of a democracy, who's got the power?
When you and David Shaler resigned from MI5, your intention was to blow the whistle on illegality. David took documents to prove your allegations to the Mail on Sunday, which published them in August of 1997. What was the immediate fallout from the government? What was the response from the public?
The immediate fallout from the government was interesting because this was the newly elected landslide victory of Tony Blair. And we thought, you know, Labour government after how long of, you know, Conservative government in the UK would mean that they would take our allegations more seriously. What we wanted to do was create a bit of a scandal and ensure that there was going to be a proper inquiry into how the spies were running amok and to make sure that there were reforms put in place to regulate what they were doing. Then they needed to be tighter than even the reforms that were put in place in the 1980s. So that was our aim. It didn't quite work out that way because 1 week after the allegations came out, and there was a huge press push for an inquiry. 1 week after we made the allegations, Princess Diana died in Paris. So everything else got sort of blanked out with this huge media hysteria about the death of Princess Diana. So you can try and factor in most things in life and try and plan for most things in life, but something like that was on a different scale. And so we found ourselves sort of lost in Europe on the run and living in hiding and without much press support. Up until that point, though, the press were beginning to get very angry about the government response because the government tried to injunct them, to try to gag them, tried to shut them up, in terms of pressurizing for a proper inquiry into what the spies were doing illegally.
A judge blocked the Mail on Sunday from publishing the allegations you were making that concerned the IRA specifically. But what about the other information? What about the attempt on Gaddafi, for example? What was the reaction from the government, from the courts, and from the public?
This is a weird one because the Gaddafi plot, as it became known, which was an MI6 funded backing an al-Qaeda group in Libya to try and assassinate a foreign head of state, which went wrong and killed innocent people. I mean, how much worse can it get? Was the biggest case, and this is why we actually quit, and this is why David wanted to go public. And this was the story that did not get published initially, and he had to fight to get it out there. So finally, after about a year when we were living in hiding, the BBC decided to make a panorama special. And the Mail on Sunday and the Sunday Times decided to run with the story too, finally. And it was at that point that David was arrested and put into prison and had to spend 4 months in a notorious hellhole waiting a failed extradition attempt back to the UK. So in terms of how people reacted to that and how the government reacted to that, the press was incandescent. They wanted answers. They wanted to know if this was true. And what happened was that the Blair government just came out and said, this is pure fantasy. It has no basis in fact. And there's never been a proper police investigation into it. Now, when David returned to the UK in 2000 and was put on trial in 2002, served his sentence by 2003, and then he got his passport back. And when we went to pick it up from New Scotland Yard, the police officer said, we're really sorry. We were just following orders. We had to do this, go through this process. But we knew what you were saying was true. So the cover-up was astonishing. And the fact that the cover-up was so systematic at that point, and yet, you know, you fast forward to 2011, when there was the NATO bombing of Libya because there was humanitarian aid, and Gaddafi was dragged out and tortured and murdered at that point. And that was seen as a glorification of the West's power in 2011. So the moral slide between what happened in 1996 and what happened in 2011 in terms of our perception in the West is terrifying. The fact that we can laud this sort of thing rather than keep it secret and condemn it.
Shortly after the Mail on Sunday published your allegations, you and David Shaler were forced to leave the country for France. You truly believed if you were to return to the UK, you would be arrested. But you went back to London, and much to your surprise, you were not arrested, so you returned again to France. But in 1998, after David began working with the British media on a documentary about the Gaddafi plot, he was charged under the Official Secrets Act, and the French detained him at the request of the British for 4 months. What happened then?
I knew I was going back to be arrested, and I was indeed arrested at the immigration gate in Gatwick Airport. And then I was taken off to a counterterrorism suite in central London police station, and then interrogated for the rest of the day. The key point is I was never charged with anything, let alone convicted or whatever, because I hadn't done anything.
Right.
I mean, all I did was, you know, support what David was trying to do. So, yes, I was arrested. I was kept on police bail, which means you don't have to put up money, but you have to keep answering bail and going back every month. And one of David's brothers was also treated this way, and two of his best friends as well. So it was very much a case of trying to intimidate David by threatening legal penalties against the people he loved the most.
We're speaking with MI5 whistleblower Annie Machon on the odyssey that she and her partner David Shaler experienced after going public with allegations of official wrongdoing. We're going to take a short break and go deeper into this important story. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
What happens when you mix digital games with actual physical sports?
Something like digital?
The answer is yes.
Kazan is preparing to host the first ever Games of the Future, a cyber contest with a physical dimension. One of the innovators, Igor Stolyarov, is on the verge of redefining sports and gaming. He tells us what's behind this synergy and if it's the future.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with MI5 whistleblower Annie Machon about her revelations of illegality and the difficult fallout for she and her partner. Annie, in August of 2000, you and David Shaler did a very brave thing. You returned to the UK. Both of you knew what likely awaited you there, but you did it anyway. Tell us what went into your decision to return.
I think there are a number of issues around why we decided to return at that point. We'd been living in hiding and in exile for 3 years at that point in France. And from my perspective, I could still travel backwards and forwards because I'd never been charged with anything. But for David, once he'd been released from the French prison because the Brits failed to extradite him in 1998, it meant that if he had left France to go to any other European country, he would have been arrested and probably extradited from any other country. France had a particular law back in the 1990s, which said that if you were a whistleblower, it was deemed to be a political offence, and they did not extradite people for those political offences. So we'd taken advice before we went to France. We knew that was going to be legal protection, and that's why we went there. So yes, the courage that David showed when he went back to face the music, as they say, and to stand trial was quite exceptional. I mean, I'd had to do it myself without having to stand trial, but he knew he would have to. He knew he'd probably be convicted and he would probably go back to prison. And after 4 months in Paris, that was pretty bad. But he still did it because he wanted to have his evidence read into the public record in a public court of law. What happened, though, was that he returned in 2000, didn't go on trial until the end of 2002, during which there were a number of legal hearings which actually shut down every line of defense he could have used. So by the time he got in front of his jury of his peers, he was not allowed to say why he'd done what he'd done in any way. So, of course, he was convicted and he went back to prison. It was disgusting. This is the way that all whistleblowers are treated. And I think I'm talking from a British perspective, where back in the day we faced 2 years per charge in prison. They're trying to increase that to 14 years per charge in prison now, not just for the whistleblower, but also for the journalists. But of course, what we're looking at in the USA, and you will know because you've been to prison, is if you blow the whistle, you can face up to 35 years in prison per charge, as Chelsea Manning did. And as Edward Snowden, he would probably face life. And Julian Assange, but not that he's a whistleblower, he's a publisher, but even so, the penalties are appalling over in the USA. So anyone who blows the whistle and anyone who then is told to go and face the music and wants to put it on the public record what they've blown the whistle on, faces a huge penalty in the West. And people excoriate countries like Russia or China or Iran or whatever for stigmatizing and penalizing dissidents. But that's precisely what the West is doing when they treat whistleblowers in this way too.
The British government tried hard to convict and to imprison David, even if they decided not to charge you with a crime. You were by his side through the entire time. In the end, David was given 6 months in jail for violating the Official Secrets Act. We all know this incredibly short sentence was meant as a face-saving measure for the government. When governments go after former employees for violating the Official Secrets Act, or in the United States, the Espionage Act, they usually seek decades in prison. They didn't get it in this case. What happened? How did this play out?
Partly, he was facing a maximum of 6 years in prison. So that was three charges, 2 years each, under the 1989 Official Secrets Act. After he was convicted, but before he was sentenced, I was allowed to give a mitigation plea to the judge. This is the only time either of us had ever been able to say anything in public in court about why we'd done what we'd done. So I explained that. I'd explained our motivation, explained what had happened, explained everything. And the judge actually said that he had been minded to give David 13 months in prison, but he was going to give him 6 months. So that sounds really light compared to what goes on in the US. And it sounds really light to what might come into play in the UK when they bring in what they are going to call the new Espionage Act, which is an amalgamation of the old Official Secrets Act, which is going to indeed increase the tariffs for whistleblowers and journalists to 14 years rather than 2 years. So this is all to discourage others, of course. It's a power play. And I think it's so important to remember that people do not blow the whistle just because they want to, you know, get a certain bit of glory or whatever. They ruin their lives by doing it. They turn their lives inside out and upside down, and they can never regain their professional status, as you know, as I know. And for people to be penalized even more badly, with the sense of, you know, 14 years in prison because you're a traitor or something like that, you're not. You're actually trying to protect the rights of your country and your fellow citizens. You're trying to protect the very nature of democracy, rather than trying to allow the government to encroach on our civil liberties. I cannot say this strongly enough at this point as well, because one of the things I learned from all these years of whistleblowing, and also having the privilege to work with other whistleblowers, including yourself, and also to work with hacktivists, is that the more we move into the online world, and the more that we live our lives online, the easier it is for the spies to look at us, to follow us, to watch us. And if we don't have people, most recently, of course, Edward Snowden, which is almost 10 years ago, coming out and saying, this is what is happening, you know, between nation states and corporations and the hackers and the criminal hackers and all that sort of thing, we are so vulnerable. We are sitting ducks with our lives online. So we need to be aware of it. We need to spread the word about it. And we need to protect people who come out and reveal this sort of information, rather than prosecute them and persecute them, put them in prison. That's just disgusting.
One of the things that is consistent for all whistleblowers is, after the actual act of revealing evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality, life is just never the same. How have things changed for you and for David over the past 20 years?
Oh, That's a big question. No, I totally agree. And I would say this is true of all whistleblowers across all sectors, not just the intelligence, government, military, although we tend to be the ones who pay the biggest penalties. So most people will lose their professional reputation. They might lose their wherewithal to earn a living. That might lose, you know, their homes or their families or whatever it is, which is bad enough. And it should not happen if people want to expose wrongdoing and improve the work of organizations. But we are the ones who, as you know, face prison, go to prison as well. So I think the win-win situation would be a strategy where people can be encouraged to expose wrongdoing and not necessarily be publicly lauded for it, but just be recognized and not just treated as troublemakers. So that would be the first step. But yes, in terms of how you rebuild a life after doing that, it's incredibly hard. I suppose for me, I mean, it cost me my relationship with David Shaler. That disintegrated in 2007. But also, it's trying to rebuild. What I found useful was trying to learn lessons from what I'd gone through, particularly when it came to media manipulation, because I watched how the media had been manipulated during David's case. I mean, I remember sitting in the courtroom when his judgment, the final judgment, was read out, and it said David Shaler, you know, hadn't done what he'd done for money, no lives were put at risk, blah, blah, blah. And the next day, all the headlines said exactly the opposite. So it's like, hang on, how did that happen? So the media manipulation and moving forward to what's going on online and deep fakes and the derankings and the disappearances of articles online is frightening. But I think the key issue that I've really brought forward in my work now is about privacy, because during those 7 years of the whistleblowing story, you know, going on the run, living in hiding, living in exile, going through the court cases, blah, 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 I never felt that I had privacy in my own home. To this day, I don't feel I have privacy talking on the phone, with my emails, in my own home either. I'm not saying that that's happening. I'm just aware of that potential threat. So this is why I've dived deep into a lot of these sort of technical issues, trying to work out how we can protect ourselves, both individually and societally and democratically as well. So I'm going to do a shameless plug. I have a new book out. It's called The Privacy Mission. I'm sorry about that. But I work with an organization called the World Ethical Data Forum and the World Ethical Data Foundation to try and look at these sort of issues and take deep dives into them and to mitigate some of these issues as well. Particularly the intersection between corporations, government and deep state and government and things like that. Because if people are not aware, one of the potential threats and two of the potential alternatives, which might be much more utopian rather than dystopian, then we have no hope. So it's all about education. It's all about trying to make people aware. And I think that's what whistleblowers do. That is the thing. This is the key motivation for all of us, I think, as whistleblowers, is to try and make people aware. So even though my whistleblowing was 25 years ago, I still try and make people aware now of other things that I find fascinating and interesting and I can see might be potential threats, but there might be potential bonuses and benefits from the technology that we're now working with, particularly as we now will have to live our lives online.
Annie, you have been one of Julian Assange's most outspoken supporters in the UK. Tell us what's new in Julian's case. We know what is probably his final appeal of his extradition to the United States is being heard right now. We've come to understand those of us who support Julian should expect nothing from the UK government. What are Julian's chances in the British court system at this point? Is there any hope for him in the European Court of Human Rights? And is there any reason to believe that the new Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, will be any different toward Julian than Boris Johnson and Liz Truss were?
I think my face probably said it all. I would doubt it. The British system is rigged, and also they're a bit of a vassal state towards the US anyway. We know that. I mean, you know, they're out of the EU. They need the US. But the whole point about the Assange case is that he is an Australian publisher and journalist, award-winning. He's won global awards over the years. And he is imprisoned in the UK and wanted by the US under espionage charges, which is absolute rubbish. So the key point is, one, it should not be happening to someone who is not an American, who has not been a spy, is not involved in espionage. He is a publisher, pure and simple. The case around him as well means that all journalists around the world are equally vulnerable to predations by the US legal system. Anyone who writes anything that might challenge the US hegemony, be it, you know, some sort of war somewhere in some country most people aren't even interested in, of course the people in the country are going to be totally interested and totally horrified by it. But it just means that reporting and proper journalism is going to be stifled, because if that can happen to Julian, as an award-winning global journalist, it can happen to anyone else. I remember a quote, it was by, I think it was the New York Times editor way back in the day. It was a guy called Bill Kellner, something like that. And he was one of the very first journalist partners that Julian worked with, along with The Guardian in the UK. And the New York Times editor said, we don't consider him a publisher, we consider him just a source. And I found this absolutely astonishing, because either he's a publisher, which means that, okay, he's published that, the New York Times published that, that means you're equally vulnerable, or he is a source, but the source, protection of the sources, is the prime directive of any good journalist. So how can you say he's just a source and not protect him? So in a sense, that shot the whole concept of proper investigative journalism in both feet with both barrels. I can't believe that the editor of the New York Times at that point said that. So Julian's case is so important. It's such a case of principle, as well as the case of a poor man being tortured psychologically for years now and wrongfully attacked. But it's such a principle for journalism around the world. And I can't believe that more journalists, and shame on them for not doing it, across the West, and not standing up for him.
Thank you so much to our guest, Annie Mashon, and thank you for joining us. I'm John Kiriakou. Tune in next time for another episode of The Whistleblowers.